From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made at the intersection of Routes 98 and 104 in Gaines, a place called the Hamlet of Childs. It's just a few miles north of the village of Albion. And while this small rural community doesn't take up much space on a map, three of its buildings have received national attention. A cobblestone church, a cobblestone house, and a cobblestone school are listed as a National Historic Landmark, the highest historic designation a site can receive. It's sort of the creme de la creme of historic sites. But like other rural communities its size, the Hamlet of Childs faces challenges. Residents and advocates for historic spaces say the local museum and local businesses are threatened by an automobile-oriented design, and heavy traffic is dangerous to patrons. There have also been attempts to bring small box development to the area, specifically a Dollar General, which could change the character of the Hamlet. These are some of the reasons why the Hamlet of Childs has made the Landmark Society of Western New York's 2019 Five to Revive list. It's a list of historic sites the Society wants to prioritize for revitalization, both for the benefit of the spaces themselves and also for the surrounding neighborhoods. The Landmark Society released this year's Five to Revive on Wednesday this week. In this hour, we'll explore each of those selections and discuss the potential impact their revitalization could have. I'd like to welcome my guest. Caitlin Mivas is here. She's a preservation planner for the Landmark Society of Western New York. Welcome back.
Thanks.
And also here from the Landmark Society, Wayne Goodman, the executive director. Welcome back to you.
Thank you. Welcome. All right, I appreciate being on the show again. Thanks.
It's always fun to talk about the Five to Revive every year, so I'm glad to have you both back in what I think are your regular seats, so that's nice. Katie Eggers-Como is here. She's an architectural historian with Barrow Architecture, PLLC, and also a member of the Five to Revive Selection Committee. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Doug Farley's here. He's the director of the Cobblestone Museum in the Hamlet of Childs. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Later in the hour, we'll be joined by Frances Stern, manager of the technical and grant programs for the Preservation League of New York State. She'll help us talk about a few of the issues related to what's going on in Childs. And in just a few minutes, we'll hear from Joanne Beck, president of the Highland Park Conservancy. And here I am revealing a few of the clues to what's on the list this year. But WXXI News, among other outlets, reported it on Wednesday. Caitlin and Wayne, we've had great conversations about Five to Revive listings in the past. So let's just go quickly through this year's list and what stands out to you this year.
So we have a couple of individual properties. We've got Highland Reservoir and Cobbs Hill Reservoir in the city of Rochester. We've got a vacant house in the Susan B. Anthony neighborhood called it's at 6 Madison Street, just off of Main Street. We have a thematic listing that is kind of overwhelming, but also exciting and daunting. It's the adaptive reuse of historic houses of worship, so churches, synagogues, any denomination, but that's been a historic house of worship, and that really needs to be looking at, in addition to religious use, kind of alternative uses. And then we have a building in the village of Dansville called the King's Daughters and Sons Building. And finally, we have the Hamlet of Childs, as you mentioned.
Wayne, what stands out to you this year?
Well, I think, first of all, I think it's a tremendous list this year. The committee did a fantastic job. I think that the listing that really stands out and pops out, as Caitlin mentioned, is a bit daunting, but also really exciting, is this adaptive use of historic houses of worship. It's certainly a problem that we see all across the nation, not just simply in Western New York. And we simply see a high level of concern because I think primarily of dwindling congregational numbers, which then translates into very limited funding capacity to maintain these beautiful, large historic places of worship.
I think the data you shared and that I've found on, I believe it was Salon, I think 6,000 to 10,000 churches are closing every year in the United States. So we're seeing a lot of historic spaces not being used up for redevelopment or revitalization. We're going to dig deeply into that issue this hour and talk to Katie about her thoughts on that. But I just want to talk to you, Wayne and Caitlin, about the program as a whole. Every year we talk about the Five to Revive. We have a great time learning about and exploring these spaces. And this is on us as a media organization, myself and Evan in particular on the show. We rarely follow up. Mm-hmm. We rarely ask you what's going on with the Auditorium Theater, which was on the list one year, the Eastman Dental Dispensary, or the National Yeast Company and Iroquois Motor Car Factory in Seneca Falls. So just for a few minutes, I'd like to talk about what are some of the major success stories that you may have seen that haven't been reported, and what's sort of still kind of waiting to be developed or hasn't received the funding or attention you think it deserves?
Well, when this program was initiated a number of years ago, 7 years ago, I think now, the term that our organization used was catalytic. The fact that we, as an organization concerned with historic preservation, should be finding representative projects that are in need, but that also have a chance of improving the district, the community in which those properties sit. You know, you had mentioned a couple of former projects. I remember the Eastman Dental Dispensary was an early listing in the program. You know, there was a local developer recently who referenced our Five to Revive list as their pipeline. And it's a pipeline to find opportunities for investment, the specific sites. But it's also a pipeline that opens the door to further funding through grants, tax credit projects that make adapting and rehabilitating these structures even possible. So that's why we do it. And you're right, we have enjoyed considerable success. And I don't know, Caitlin, you want to mention a few?
I think one of the past listings that we're probably, Wayne and I are probably most excited about is the former Holly High School in the Village of Holly. Home leasing, folks may have seen in the news as taking that on. This is a huge project. It's a large early 20th century high school building that was pretty much vacant since the late 1980s. So to see a developer that, you know, has the track record and the ability to take on such a daunting project like that, they're converting it to mixed income residential units, to commercial, community space in the auditorium. So, and it'll be providing housing for seniors in the village. So that is a huge investment in the Village of Holly. And I think that building sat vacant for so long that probably people just assumed it would continue to crumble. And so that's hugely exciting to
us. And that building is also, I think, representative of our goal to be catalytic because of its location within the village. It has a striking, anchoring location within the village. And its vacancy for the decades has certainly not helped the Village of Holly. And so we're incredibly excited, and I know that we join the Village of Holly in their excitement.
What happens after the list is produced? Do people contact you with ideas? Do you try to receive historic tax credits for those spaces yourselves? What's the process after you decide on the five every year?
Every property is different and unique and kind of requires a unique approach. So, you know, we reach out to stakeholders in the community. If it's owned by a local government, you know, we reach out to those folks and say, we sit down and say, you know, what can we do to help? What's the pivot point here? You know, do you need a developer? Do we need to raise money? Is it owned by a nonprofit? When we worked with, for example, the folks with the Samson Theater in Penn Yan, that was owned by a nonprofit theater company. You know, their board was composed of theater folks. So, you know, we gave them some zoomed out big picture advice. You know, on your board, you need folks who can help you fundraise and make connections. And, you know, you need to diversify your board. So we got them connected with a development consultant who could help them do that kind of stuff and help them do fundraising and make connections. So that project is moving forward. So it's kind of everything from building focus, but also big picture organization focus, community focus. It really depends. We've been really, really involved in Parrot Hall in Geneva, which was on the list last year. And we've worked with a coalition of organizations that includes the City of Geneva, a local friends group, the Preservation League of New York State, and we've all worked collaboratively on that one. That's really required a lot of on-the-ground work. So we have a $400,000 grant from the state to help do some stabilization on that, and we're going to be doing a feasibility study to figure out what can be some potential reuses for that. And that building is owned by State Park, so we're working collaboratively with them to do all of this and kind of map out the future for that building.
I don't know if it's possible to put a number or percentage on the projects that are in motion that have been on the lists since 2013, but we're seeing more than two dozen projects on the list. What percentage would you guess are in the works toward being revitalized?
Well, I can tell you we've only lost one.
Oh, is that the Hotel de May?
Yes,
yeah.
So in Greece.
Tell
yeah.
our listeners a little bit about
yes.
what happened there.
So it was in the former hamlet of North Greece. And it was one of the spots in Greece where you can really see some of the early 20th and late 19th century history of the community. And it was just kind of a crossroads in the community. And this was a former hotel where people would come up to us and, oh, we got married there. My mom got married there. I have all these memories, blah, blah, blah. So people had a lot of emotional connection to that place. But there was a proposal before the town to replace it with a gas station and convenience store. So we weren't successful and the owner was selling the property to that developer. And we just weren't successful in, convincing the owner to look at alternatives or convincing the town to not rezone the property to allow that. So that one was unfortunately a loss, but we've got a lot. There are a lot that are in the works.
Yeah, I think that it would depend on how we choose to define success of the listings. Certainly, we've only lost that one property that Caitlin mentioned. I would say that a good number of the other listings from previous years are either completed or are in a pipeline. And there's certainly a few that are in, I guess, what we would call holding pattern.
Okay, great. Well, we have the rest of the hour to delve into each project specifically, and I'd like to start with Highland Reservoir and Cobbs Hill Reservoir in Rochester. Listeners, if you're not familiar with those two spaces, you can find pictures of them on the Landmark Society's website, but also on my Twitter feed at mmacmedia. Our intern, Emma Ray Stein, is helping us out with that this hour. Wayne, tell us a little bit about those two reservoirs. Why did that make the list this year?
Well, I guess to really summarize a fairly complex issue, the city of Rochester is seeking to comply with federal regulations in order to protect our drinking water supply. And so that means that these two reservoirs, the water in those reservoirs need to be protected and treated in some way. So there's a variety of different options on the table, which includes covering the reservoirs. These are designed landscapes originating back to Frederick Law Olmsted and the Olmsted Brothers firm. So the water features are not only a utilitarian design to provide the city fresh and safe drinking water, but the reservoirs are also an integral part to a historic design landscape. So we feel like that there are options available to comply with these regulations and at the same time making sure that we are respectful in preserving a really beautiful and meaningful historic landscape.
Joanne Beck is the president of the Highland Park Conservancy, and she's been listening on the phone. Joanne, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Hi. What's your reaction to having those two spaces on the list? I'm sure that's a good thing for you, right?
It's a great thing because, the improvements that are going to be done for the reservoirs, there are many alternatives, and there are many design decisions. And design is basically the physical record of values. And so we at Highland Park Conservancy want to elevate the values of scenic quality and historic integrity in both of those projects. I mean, starting with Highland Reservoir, because that's the one that's underway. And we have been working, our major project at Highland Park Conservancy is the reconstruction of the historic Children's Pavilion, which is located just above the Highland Reservoir, and the reservoir is part of the view that the Children's Pavilion featured. And we have a goal of dedicating that pavilion in the year 2022. We're about two-thirds of the way to our fundraising goal of $3 million. And the date for the implementation of the improvements to Highland Reservoir are 2023. So we have a very, very strong interest in helping the Water Bureau, being of assistance to the Water Bureau in identifying the best solutions to preserve scenic quality and historic integrity of the park.
When in your mind, Joanne, is that best solution?
Well, they haven't actually given us definitive alternatives. What is going to happen next is they're going to do an environmental impact analysis, which is appropriate, absolutely appropriate to this kind of project, and provide not only the design alternatives, but the impacts of those alternatives for full public disclosure, which is the whole purpose of, you know, the EIS environmental impact process. So the city has committed to doing a visual impact analysis of the alternatives, and that will give everybody a look at what's being proposed, so that there can be meaningful public input to the process. They've also committed to do historic resource analysis, so we will know what will be lost and how to minimize what will be lost of historic fabric.
Thanks, Joanne. Our intern, Emma Ray Stein, had a chance to walk around the reservoirs on Wednesday when it was pouring rain, but she was out there with a recorder and had a chance to take a look and talk to some people in the area. I want to bring her into the conversation now. Emma Ray, what were your impressions of those spaces?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me on, Megan. It was really heartwarming to see, even in this crazy, tumultuous weather that was going on, there were so many people out enjoying the reservoir, specifically at Cobbs Hill, but also at Highland. But I'd like to focus for a minute on what I saw at Cobbs Hill. There were people of all ages, all backgrounds, walking around the pathway there. There were people that were with a spouse. There were younger groups that were going underneath some of the shelter that's provided there for exercise. There were people who are on jogs, which I commend them for, because, I don't know how they're doing it in that weather. But it was really hopeful. And something that I kept hearing time and time again was that these reservoirs act as spaces where people can meet individuals who perhaps they never thought that they would stumble upon. They can make these unique connections that they never thought that they would forge. And one of the questions that I asked was, what do you think would be missing from the landscape of the park if the reservoir was no longer here? I asked that in both situations. And what I heard time and time again was that they felt that something would be missing from the integrity of the entire landscape, that a piece of Rochester would have left and would have fallen if it was not there in the state that it was at the time. And they're just so excited about seeing what the future holds, how the reservoir can be improved, but also how, in the same sense, how we can keep that sort of structural continuance going so that there's not too many alterations, but that we can show some love for these spaces.
And I know you had a chance to talk with a resident named John.
Yes.
Let's hear what John had to say.
Just a sense of Rochester, the history. There's history on the plaques up there, how long this
for
has
sure.
been here. It's a natural resource for our water supply. People respect that. There's just no place in Rochester like it. I mean, the Highland Park Reservoir is nice, but they don't have an area where you can walk all the way around. It gives you how much you're doing for yourself by the footage and all that kind of stuff. So you know when you're walking around, you're like 0.67% of a mile. So you can judge that. It's my happy place.
That's awesome to hear. Katie, I know you have some expertise in this area as well. What do you think is the biggest challenge when it comes to both of these reservoirs? What are you concerned about?
Well, it's always a balancing act with these types of projects because obviously a safe water supply is essential. We have to have that. So it's really critical that the visual impact not be lost either. And I should say that I wear a couple of different hats when it comes to this. I'm a board member of the National Association for Olmsted Parks. I'm also part of the design team because Barrow Architecture is helping with the evaluation of historic impacts that Joanne mentioned. I'm involved in local Olmsted advocacy here too. So it's definitely critical that these conversations are happening now at the outset of the project, because far too often, and this is kind of common to throughout the Five to Revive types of things that end up on this list, that if you're not considering the historic impacts right at the beginning, it can often be too late and other considerations kind of take over, and then you're scrambling to catch up. So fortunately, we are going to have the evaluation that Joanne talked about. But I'm concerned. You know, I live very close to Cobbs Hill Park. That's where I go to walk as well. And there is just something about being out there. And if there were a lot of people there on a rainy day, you should see it on a beautiful evening at 5 o'clock. It is just packed with people. So, you know, these are treasures. And once they're gone, you can't get them back.
Mm-hmm. Well, Joanne Beck, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. Keep us posted on your progress over there. And I'm sure we'll be chatting with you again soon.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Moving on to our next space on the list, I know I have a lot of questions about this one, Caitlin. 6 Madison Street in the Susan B. Anthony neighborhood. Why did that one make the list?
So this is a property, it's owned by the city of Rochester. It's been vacant for over 20 years. And we've been working with the city on this for a couple of years, and the neighborhood, the Susan B. Anthony Neighborhood Association as well. And we really wanted to put it on the list because part of the function of putting things on the Five to Revive list is it becomes a priority project for our staff. And we need... I need to be able to make things a priority because, you know, we have a 9-county region. So there's never, you know, a shortage of buildings for us to help people with. So we really wanted to make this a priority, partially because of the 200th anniversary coming up in the Susan B. Anthony neighborhood. And this is kind of the Susan B. Anthony neighborhood and the Main Street corridor have had a lot of investment over the last several years. And this is kind of the one remaining vacant, unrehabbed house in the neighborhood. And so we really wanted to be able to work with the city and the neighborhood to bring some resources to bear and get this last project finished so it can be contributing and be a community asset again.
What's your hope for the space, Wayne?
Well, I think that as Caitlin mentioned, this is one of the last pieces we feel like to this neighborhood's puzzle. The local support for preservation, I think, has only grown over the past several years. The city's commitment to that district, I think, is admirable. So I think we would like to see this structure really placed back into single-family dwelling. I think that the investment in this particular case, unlike maybe some other examples in our Five to Revive, the past investment in that district actually sets the stage and builds a foundation for preserving this structure. So it's a challenge, no doubt about it. If it wasn't a challenge, it wouldn't have been vacant for the past 20 years. But we're certainly hopeful that by adding this property to the list that we attract attention and possibly additional funding opportunities, because we feel like that's what's going to move this from the Five to Revive to the Revived list.
And we've, a few years ago, we were able to help fund for the neighborhood a feasibility study that looked at some reuse options and one potential model for funding that, which is called the Main Street LLC model that the mayor of the village of Perry developed, Rick Hauser. And that's a kind of a community-based LLC where just normal, everyday people invest whatever money they can afford to not see for a little while. So it's $1,000, $500, and you just get people from the community to invest enough money that you can then leverage that to get a bank loan and make a project happen. So that was one model that we looked at for rehabbing the property. So, you know, we want to be able to work with the city to pursue that and, you know, just see what options work best for the neighborhood and for the property.
We've had conversations on this program with both of you involved at some point about gentrification, concerns about that. How is the Susan B. Anthony neighborhood evolving as a whole? Is that a concern in that space?
I think in the Susan B. Anthony neighborhood, we haven't seen much displacement. I think most of the housing in that neighborhood is pretty affordable. And that's part of, you know, what makes this rehabbing a property like this a little bit more of a fun challenge is that, you know, the resale values are still relatively low in that neighborhood, which is a good thing for keeping it affordable for folks, but it makes you know, it makes the rehab a little bit more challenging too. But we still believe that it's not an insurmountable challenge.
Yeah, we see this throughout Rochester's neighborhoods. If on one hand, we're always, you know, concerned about the gentrification question. And the flip side of that is it becomes difficult to raise private capital in some neighborhoods. And that's why we need to be working with a variety of different partners to pull these types of projects off.
And we'll be working, too, with a nearby nonprofit, the 540 West Main Community, that's run by Calvin Eaton. And he works, 540 West Main works on displacement issues a lot. So, you know, working with partners like that will help, you know, help us ensure that we're being sensitive to those kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll take our only break of the hour, and when we come back, we'll talk about this year's thematic listing, the adaptation and reuse of historic houses of worship. I really enjoyed hearing about these broader categories, these thematic listings over the years. So we'll talk a little bit about how the progress with those are going with our guests, Caitlin Mivas and Wayne Goodman from the Landmark Society, Katie Eggers Cuomo, an architectural historian with Barrow Architecture, Doug Farley, director of the Cobblestone Museum in the Hamlet of Childs, and we'll also hear from Francis Stern, manager of technical and grant programs for the Preservation League of New York State. Short break, more Connections next. I'm Megan Mack. Monday on The Next Connections, do you find it difficult or easy to forgive? An upcoming conference will explore the impact of forgiveness and the effectiveness of restorative practices in different settings. We'll talk about restorative circles and more. Then in our second hour, a conversation about what's called passion-based learning. We'll talk about the Muse School in California, where students choose what they want to learn about. We'll talk about the strengths and weaknesses. You're listening to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about the Landmark Society of Western New York's Five to Revive list, which was revealed on Wednesday. And the press conference was held on Parcells Avenue at a very historic church, Parcells Avenue Church. And this is one of the year's thematic listings. So we've talked about the front porch in the past, about the traditional trades, which I've really enjoyed hearing about. So, Caitlin, tell us a little about why you chose this theme this year.
So part of the work that we do at Landmark Society is, you know, we pick up the phone and go out and meet with whoever calls us and wants our help, you know, whether it's a homeowner, developer, a local government, what have you. But a lot of the calls that we get are from historic houses of worship. And I think we're all pretty familiar with the trend of fewer folks being actively involved in organized religion. So that, as Wayne was saying earlier, that results in fewer congregants at these church and fewer funds. A lot of the grant funding for fixing up these really complex historic buildings has been reduced over the years. And so it's a real challenge for dwindling congregations. Often, you know, the folks running them are, you know, getting up in age and they have dwindling numbers, dwindling amounts of financial resources. So we're constantly working with folks from various denominations to figure out, you know, how we can help them fundraise, how we can help them keep their buildings operational, or, you know, is there, and one of the solutions, bottom line is not every congregation can stay, unfortunately, in their buildings. It's just not feasible. You know, if you've got 20 people worshiping in a space that holds 200, that's not really sustainable. So we've seen, work in several communities throughout the country and a few projects in Buffalo is this concept of adaptive reuse, taking an old building and adapting it to a new and different use. And what we've seen in some examples with these historic houses of worship is putting a new use, especially if you have a campus of buildings, especially with Catholic campuses, you know, you'll have the church, you might have dormitories, you might have a school building, and doing a partnership between a developer and the congregation where an economically viable use goes into some of those buildings, but then the congregation can maybe still stay there and use it as worship space. So focusing on projects like that as a way to keep some of these buildings viable in their communities is what we're really looking at with this listing.
And the four churches are, Wayne, let's talk about the four properties themselves. We've got Parcells Avenue Community Church, which is where the press conference was held. Mm-hmm. What are the other three?
Wesleyan Trinity Episcopal Church, and then the Wesleyan Church. But I think we should point out that the thematic listing really goes beyond just the specific sites that we're I guess, marketing. The thematic listing can carry over city limits on into the region, because this is a concern, and I've been in the preservation field for upwards of 20 years, and I can remember this starting to become a major issue 20 years ago, and we still really haven't been able to grasp the solutions and really convey the solutions to the people who need to hear them. You know, these structures are designed to be powerful, inspirational, awe-inspiring buildings. And because of that, it becomes an extremely emotional and a difficult time for congregants to let go of that structure. As Caitlin pointed out, in many of these situations, we've been able to become a facilitator in almost becoming a matchmaker and bringing in a variety of community services into these places of worship, bringing in traditional and non-traditional partners and investors. In some cases, these congregations can sell the building, sell it to a new owner who rehabs it for a new use, and then the congregation is able to meet there and continue their worship services. We often tell those that we meet with that, you know, places of worship really well. That's what they're for. That's what they do. That's their reason for existing. Sometimes when they're overwhelmed with the high maintenance cost of the structures, there's a great benefit derived from partnering with a partner who actually does understand those issues. And then the church can focus on what it does best.
And I think Trinity Episcopal in Geneva is a really great example. And Katie's been working with a developer on that, where we've got a developer lined up and a great new use.
Yeah, he mentioned, I watched a video that in which he spoke about some of the community opposition to the project before he did a formal presentation and explained what his goals were. But Katie, what was some of the miscommunication as he described it?
Well, there are a handful of neighbors who are in the immediate area who are opposed. I'm not sure what they would like to see instead. You have a building there that, as Wayne has talked about, you know, they're down to a handful of members of the congregation. I think it's between 30 and 50 in a building that was built for, you know, hundreds. So they can't continue in that way. They're partnering with the developer with the intention of turning the sanctuary of the church into an event space, and then the attached, it was kind of built in three phases. So the attached area would be a small inn. I think it's 26 rooms, something like that. So they would be able to hold weddings there, have it as an inn for, you know, people attending events or for Hobart and William Smith families, things like that. It's located right on Main Street in Geneva, which is a residential area, but not exclusively a residential area. There are a couple other bed and breakfasts in the immediate area. It's not all single-family residential. There's multifamily, too. It's a very busy street, tons of traffic. So we're not talking about, you know, a quiet, secluded neighborhood. It's a very busy area. And so I think there are some neighbors who feel that this is not the use they would like to see go in there. And, you know, they have every right to have that view. They have a right to question it and, you know, hold the city government to its, you know, hold their feet to the fire in terms of making sure this goes through the appropriate review processes. But ultimately, this building is very lucky to have this potential use. I think there's many others that would be very happy to be as suited as this one is to this type of use and have a developer interested as they are. So it's already been delayed a couple of years beyond when they were hoping to open. You know, they're going to hopefully stick this out and get through the process. But, you know, it's been tricky, and it's unfortunate because I personally believe this is a great thing for this building and this community. And I don't say that just because, you know, I'm part of the team here. I wouldn't be part of the team if I didn't believe in the project. So
I think that one of the solutions that we are consistently asking these congregations to consider is this notion of expanded and flexible use of their space. Oftentimes, as Katie just pointed out, when we're evaluating an expanded use, that typically means, okay, there might be more traffic. There might be more people coming and going. And some people who have lived nearby or in the neighborhood, that might be a difficult pill to swallow. But the flip side of that issue is then you have almost an inevitable large vacant building. And I've never really seen a large anchor vacant building do a neighborhood really any good? So there has to be some flexibility, and we feel like it's a circumstance that's unfortunate, but it's a circumstance that we really can turn into some positives.
In doing some research for this program, I read a lot about finding the balance between being practical and also being mission or values-based. Mm-hmm. And I read about some examples where churches would turn their spaces over to nonprofits that help the homeless or kids in need. What's the trending right now, Katie? Do you find that most are going toward commercial spaces, or do you think that they have a tendency to move toward more nonprofit-type ideas?
Well, there's certainly a variety. I've got one that I worked with a few years ago in the town of Olean, which is in the southern tier. It's a synagogue that, again, was down to just a very few members and couldn't keep going like that. So it was a hard decision for them, but they ended up deciding to sell their building, and that's going to be an events a performance space. So there's a community theater that's looking for a home, and they think that this building is the right size and fits what they want very well. So that's really exciting. In fact, that one I might have wanted that one to be on the Five to Revive if they weren't, you know, doing so well with this, because actually it's a really good example of a reuse that's hard for the members of the congregation, you know, to see it leave that use, but it's going to be a really good thing for the community. You know, the Lyric Theater right on East Avenue, former First Church of Christ Scientist, is another one where a performance space is a really good reuse for that building. There's always, you know, code issues and things like that. The architects I work with could speak to that a lot better than I can, but you know, some adaptations have to be made to allow for accessibility and things like that. Those are all really important. But you know, there's a variety of things that can happen. Things can become residential.
Holy Rosary on Lexington Avenue is a great example of what Katie is discussing as well. And that's the conversion to the sanctuary at Holy Rosary was done with really the architectural integrity at the forefront. And it provides that neighborhood with some excellent community-based services. So these structures, I think, pose incredible opportunities, but certainly is a shift in our way of thinking.
Well, our intern Emery Stein had a chance to visit Parcells Avenue Community Church and talk to some residents in the neighborhood. Emery, what did you find when you visited Parcells on that very rainy Wednesday?
Sure. So luckily I actually had the chance to be at Parcells right when the Landmark Society event was just starting, so I had a lot of really diverse voices to talk to. One of the things that I kept hearing time and time again from Beechwood residents was that they don't want to see Parcells become an eyesore in the neighborhood. They aren't necessarily stuck on one idea of what Parcells has to be. Some people hope that it will still be a place of worship. Some people hope that it'll be a space where the community can go and meditate, or it can be a safe space for people seeking refuge of all backgrounds. But time and time again, people said this is an important spot in the Beechwood community, and we need to be sure that it stays structurally sound and a place where people can look at and think, all right, this gives me hope for our neighborhood.
And you had a chance to talk to someone named Bob, so let's hear what Bob had to say.
Children flock here. They love to come and be at the church, and we hope to do ministry here in some form. Even though the building is in need of repair, Christ is alive in this community, and it shows, and people come over for prayer when we have outdoor worship services here on the steps. Just an exciting time, even though we have some challenges. Even when we're not in the building, people are still drawn to it. They want to see something still here. It's a time when we want to somehow continue in some capacity so that this doesn't become just an empty eyesore, but continues as a functioning building of some sort, a community center or a church or all of the above. There has to be something here to continue on to give the neighborhood hope, because the neighborhood really does need hope.
So that was Bob in the Parcells Avenue area, and that space has seen a lot of uplifting development. Maybe a lot's not the right phrase to use, but Caitlin, with New City Cafe and people investing in houses in that area, do you find that it's on an upward trend?
Yeah, and I think with organizations, our Young Preservation Organization just spent the weekend helping the City Roots Community Land Trust do some rehab work on one of the vacant houses that they've acquired. So with organizations like that, there's just a lot of grassroots work going on. And I would love to see the Parcells Church be a part of that.
Great. We'll take a few minutes and talk about the King's Daughters and Sons building in Dansville, because I'd like to spend the last part of our hour talking about the Hamlet of Childs. I know we have Francis Stern waiting on the phone, and Doug is eager to join us and share what he's doing in Childs. So just a brief moment on the building in Dansville. Wayne, can you tell us a little bit about what's going on there?
Yeah, I think that this is, it probably represents a more typical listing of a Five to Revive list or some preservation organizations call them more of an endangered list. This building has been vacant since 2012 and represented one of the first and only healthcare facilities in Dansville. And when the facility closed in 2012, there's obviously the neglect, there's the deterioration that happens with any building that is vacant. And then to compound problems, the structure, the water pipes burst, the sprinkler systems burst, and it caused even further interior damage. However, the structure is, I think, certainly not too far gone. Its integrity is there structurally. We feel like that it is sound and solid and ready for rehabilitation, and this would be a perfect single-family dwelling.
And the county, which owns it, the Livingston County, they've done, you know, the right thing by kind of holding on to it and not just putting it up for auction so that, you know, an investor can buy it on the internet for $10,000, which is what we've seen with some of our other Five to Revive properties. So we're really looking forward to working with the county and getting this building, you know, maybe in the hands of a developer who has the resources to rehab it.
That's an 1860 three-story brick building and a former seminary, then a hospital, eventually an assisted living facility. I found one quote from a Livingston County administrator in 2016 who said, "It looks like a bomb went off in the middle of it." So I'm sure you're glad it's on the list this year, Wayne and Caitlin.
Yeah, you know, it's mostly, it's the plaster damage from the burst pipe, and, you know, it's still, we've seen far worse, let me tell you.
Fair enough. Moving on to the Hamlet of Childs in the town of Gaines, that's in Orleans County. I have to admit, Doug, I apologize. I did not know where Childs was until I started doing some research for the show. But what should our listeners know about Childs?
I think it's a great little community, kind of nestled between, say, the Genesee River and the Niagara River, right in the middle on historic Route 104. It's just a little unknown gem at this point, but when you consider the historic integrity of the small little community, I think people will be impressed. And if they do come out to visit us, they're going to see a community with some really nice cobblestone buildings, and the Cobblestone Museum anchoring that, of course, interpreting the history of cobblestone architecture, and a mixture of brick buildings and wood frame buildings that were built in the early 1800s. We have the Tillman's Village Inn, which was originally a stagecoach stop, tavern, and inn in the early 1820s. And we just have a nice assortment of gift shops and other buildings that are just waiting for that public input to move to the next level, where we become a destination that people really want to come see what's happening here. And people just don't drive by and not realize they've driven through it. We need that extra help with our infrastructure to make sure that we have the necessary signage and streetscaping and wayfinding, all the things that might possibly come out of this wonderful Five to Revive effort.
Listeners, you're hearing from Doug Farley, the director of the Cobblestone Museum in the Hamlet of Childs. Your museum sits at the on the two corners in the Hamlet, is that correct?
We have a big footprint.
Yeah, I guess so.
When you consider the National Historic Landmark District, or the Cobblestone District, it actually takes up a quarter mile.
Oh, okay, great.
So we have a large area to cover.
And I know that you've been involved in, I don't know if the word fight is appropriate here, but the conversations about some small box development, particularly a Dollar General, mm-hmm. that was anticipated to move into the area. Tell us a little bit about what's going on with that project.
Well, at the present time, it appears to be on hold, so that's wonderful news as far as the Cobblestone Museum is concerned, because we were very concerned that a intrusive new big small box store, which in essence, in the size of our buildings, it would be a medium box for sure, would just be so out of character with what we have to offer in terms of historic preservation and interpretation. But we did find out about a year into the process that there was going to be one of the larger dollar store chains. I'm not going to mention them by name, but maybe you will. I just don't.
I honestly don't know, so I can't.
I just don't want to get sued.
You can write it on a paper.
One of the bigger dollar store chains that are opening 3 stores a day, over 1,200 new stores a year, and seem to be doing that with complete impunity in the small communities in the United States, in the town of Gaines where this was proposed, just seem to be not at all concerned with the fact that they were allowing this to take place in the center of a National Historic Landmark District when even their own zoning ordinance had created a historic district to preserve the historic integrity. How anyone in their thinking could decide that a dollar store, a modern dollar store, would fit within the character of our community, it just boggles my mind. But we did face that. We found out a year after the process had started, which is a shame. And it was very hard to slow down that train once it was moving, but we understand that the project is currently on hold. There are some steps that can be taken to help any other community that may be facing this. I would suggest you get involved before Dollar General makes that application to come to town, because they are going to make it. If you have some historic assets in your community that you think should be preserved and you don't think a Dollar General sitting right next door would be a good idea, you need to get involved now. You need to talk to your appointed zoning boards. They are never elected. They're always appointed. And they answer to no voters. So you need to be working with them so they understand the importance of maintaining the historic integrity of that particular district. So there are some things that can be done to combat Dollar General before they get there, because once they start the process, it's a steamroller.
Well, Frances Stern is the manager of technical and grant programs for the Preservation League of New York State. She's been listening to this conversation. Frances, thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I know this is an issue that you've studied in depth, and I think some critics may push back on Doug and say, well, you know, there isn't a lot of retail in a space like that, so maybe people may need a Dollar General. They need a space that they can go to and buy a variety of items. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
Yeah, I do think that's a fair criticism. So the thing about these types of stores, and I guess we can backtrack a little bit and we can talk about the difference between what we're calling a small box development versus a big box development. When you think of big boxes, you think of places like Walmart Supercenter. Those stores usually average out at about 105,000 square feet. When you think of a small box store, it's some type of convenience store that might be about 7,500 square feet, anywhere up to 15,000 square feet, so much less in size. And these are places that sell a very curated collection of goods that are really just supposed to help you get through the week. So maybe it's a place where you can go and pick up cold medicine for your child and toilet paper and milk, or places where you can go to just find what you need and then go back home, places where you wouldn't want to spend the gas or the time to travel to a different location that's farther away from where you live. So it's always a question of, well, these types of places, the developers that are building these types of stores are usually targeting places where there aren't these other resources. So small rural communities that might have a small town center or a small village center, places that are farther away from other larger convenience chains. And that's their idea of the ideal spot to put these in. So the other thing that I will say is that this isn't really a new issue in terms of historic preservation. It's just that as time goes on, it changes forms. So back in 1999, the National Trust for Historic Preservation, they have a listing similar to Five to Revive. Theirs is called 11 Most Endangered. They listed the corner of Maine and Maine on their 1999 11 Most Endangered list. And that was just a thematic listing made to draw attention to this issue, that there are developers, convenience store developers, pharmacy developers, that are interested in having this prime real estate in small communities at the corner of Maine and Maine, where they can put a store that will provide convenience services for people, but also be in a good location for their business.
And Frances, I'm sorry to interrupt you, just because we're down to our last minute and a half. What do you think is the best way to find a balance between providing for the needs of the community and preserving historic spaces. I hate to tell you to answer that question in 30 seconds, but we're just down to the end of the program.
I think the best thing that communities can do is just prepare ahead of time. So think about what's important to your community character and how you want to preserve that, either through creating a historic district or strong zoning practices where there's going to be community input in design guidelines. Because new development isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just a good idea to move forward in an intelligent way and think about the past and historic preservation as well.
Well, we will certainly be following what's happening in Childs. We'll check back in with Doug and Francis on that. Francis, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Well, down to our last minute, well, less than a minute, Caitlin and Wayne. And what are you hoping to accomplish within the next few months specifically?
Just to touch base with all of our partners and stakeholders on these properties and kind of chart a course forward and see how we can all work together to get these properties, you know, contributing to their communities in a more productive way.
And we will do a better job on following up on what's happening all as right. we move forward. So we don't just have one conversation every year. My thanks to Caitlin Mivas and Wayne Goodman from the Landmark Society of Western New York. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Thank
it's
you.
Always great.
Katie Eggers-Como, architectural historian with Barrow Architecture, thank you for your expertise.
Thanks so much.
Doug Farley was here. Thanks so much to you.
Come visit.
Say hi to everyone in Childs. Our thanks to Emma Ray Stein, our intern. Excellent reporting from her today. Tim Shea is our volunteer. Thanks, Tim. Rob Braden is our stellar engineer. Thank you, Rob. You're listening to Barsook Records and Rah Rah Riot. I'm Megan Mack. Evan will be back Monday. Have a great weekend, everyone, and thanks for supporting member-supported public radio.